à l'histoire des États-Unis. Le titre de cette conférence, c'est Les États-Unis, un pays sans histoire, point d'interrogation. On va pouvoir en discuter avec nos quatre invités. Juste à mes côtés, Glenn Cook. Glenn Cook, à qui l'on doit notamment La Compagnie Noire et Garrett, détective privé, pour ces deux séries, mais aussi Les Instrumentalités de la Nuit. Et on verra avec lui, en termes d'histoire sur les États-Unis, comment ça s'organise. Et oui, tout.
Yes. That's not working, but yes, I am Glenn Cook.
Is it? It's good?
There, I got it. Working now, yes. Thank you. My thoughts, in essence, on whether or not America has a history is that, yes, it does. But its history in its early times is the history of Europe. Then it's the history of European exploration. Then it's the history of European colonization. And then with the Seven Years' War and the victory of Montcalm on the Plains of Abraham, both Canada and the United States, or what would become the United States, are literally born at that point and begin both to develop their own identities and become their own history, or create their own history that is not a European history.
Parmi les autres invités, juste à ses côtés, Jess Morrow, à qui l'on doit notamment Le Dernier Chasseur de Sorcières ou la trilogie de Jéhovah. On va revenir tout de suite avec Jess Morrow. À ses côtés, Norman Spinrad, avec Rêve de Fer, mais aussi Il est parmi nous et Oussama. On va peut-être parler de l'histoire un peu plus contemporaine par rapport aux autres invités, quoique, hein, ça se discute. Et tout au bout, Lucius Shepard, vous pouvez lire en ce moment Le Dragon Griot, l'excellent livre aux éditions du Bélial. Mais aussi, il y a quelques années, est paru Louisiana Breakdown. On pourra aussi en reparler en termes d'histoire et de mythe américain. Jess Morrow, ce titre de cette conférence, Les États-Unis, un pays sans histoire, est-ce que ça vous interpelle? Est-ce que c'est un peu provocateur, évidemment? Comment vous, et vous en termes d'écrivain, vous voyez cette histoire des États-Unis?
I was talking at breakfast, at petit déjeuner with Jean-Claude Dunyac, and his understanding of the panel topic turns on the fact that if you're European, you can't travel anywhere without encountering something that's very old, some reminder of how long civilization has been evolving in the continent of Europe. You can't walk down the street of Nantes here, for example, without encountering a castle. We have no castles in the United States, for the simple reason that the medieval era came and went before these shores were colonized by Europeans. America has sometimes been called a phenomenon rather than a civilization. And while we indeed have a history, and we'll maybe get to some of the details of American history later in the hour, our collective understanding of our own history, sometimes our collective amnesia, we often have a convenient amnesia about our own history. This notion of phenomenon as opposed to civilization perhaps does make us ahistorical. I don't know, I'm not an historian. I immediately think of the famous joke, what's the difference between Americans and Europeans? Americans think that 100 years is a long time, and Europeans think that 100 miles is a great distance.
Même question un petit peu pour Norman Spinrad. À l'énoncé de cette conférence, qu'est-ce que vous êtes dit? C'est un peu provocateur. Comment est-ce que vous voyez l'histoire des États-Unis?
Well, I wasn't sure whether this is going to be about the past, the present, or the future.
just one comment on the past of American civilization is something that William Burroughs said, which is if you think North America is a young continent, spend some time in Mexico. In fact, I have, for various reasons, a lot of contact with what people who call themselves Native Americans and we call Indians now, and they would have a great objection to the idea that the history of America is only a couple of hundred years old, and for them, like a couple of hundred bad years. On the other hand, about a decade ago or more, Frederick Fukuyama announced the end of history with the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. On September 11th, Osama bin Laden very emphatically announced that this wasn't so. And he also said afterwards that he was going to destroy American civil liberties, among other things. Well, just to bring this really close to home, there was another guest who was supposed to be here, which was Tim Powers. And apparently, he wasn't able to get here because Homeland Security wouldn't let him on the airplane because there was something vaguely wrong with his passport. We don't know what that is. This is something that has changed. As far as history goes, we have had 10 years of war in the United States and in the West, and it's still going on. That's even a fairly long war for Europe. It's the longest war in American history. It's still going on. It's a world war of a different kind. So we are right back in history being made here, which is probably going to be long-term history. And another way of connecting this up to European history is this can be taken as another battle in a war that's been going on for, say, 1,000 years or so between Christianity and Islam.
Une petite question à James Moreau, puisque dans le dernier Chasseur de sorcières, on parle notamment du procès des sorcières de Salem, épisode historique américain. Qu'est-ce qui vous a intéressé dans ce fait-là? Là, pour le coup, on rentre dans les différentes parties de l'histoire américaine.
Yes, and of course, that's from the American point of view, that's ancient history. You know, that's about as far back as our history goes, I guess. 1693, something like that, the notorious Salem witch trials. The novel, The Last Witchfinder, Le Dernier Chasseur de Sorcières, begins in England with the fact of witch persecutions, the hanging of so-called witches by Matthew Hopkins was, of course, the famous English witchfinder. But I realized, and this is what I love about writing historical novels, that I could get a lot of pieces of history to sort of play into my hand. I could string events together that I don't think had ever been collected within the scope of a single novel. And I said, wait, I can work the Salem witch trials into this as well. And The theme of the novel is the coming of the Enlightenment. And whatever you think of the Puritans, they get a lot of bad press. I've heard some of it's undeserved. But you could understand the colonial era as a kind of war for the collective psyche of the colonies and then what was to become the nation between the Puritan ethos rooted in the supernatural, where the belief in demons was taken for granted, and that leads to the Salem tragedy. The war between Puritan Boston, if you will, and Quaker Philadelphia. Now, the Quakers had their supernatural beliefs as well, but when it came to persecuting witches, it was not on the table. There was more tolerance, I would argue. That's a large generalization, but the metaphor is Benjamin Franklin
cannot, reaches a point where he can't deal with the ethos of Boston, and so he travels south to the Enlightenment city, of Philadelphia. And that is indeed where the Republic is born, out of Enlightenment ideas. That is where the Declaration of Independence is written and where the Constitution is written, in Philadelphia.
Je fais juste une petite parenthèse. Y aurait-il éventuellement quelqu'un qui soit assez bon en anglais, le temps qu'on répare ce petit problème d'enregistreur, pour traduire nos questions à Lucius Shepard, éventuellement? Oui, si vous vouliez. Finir. La technique, parfois, est un petit peu compliquée. Merci à vous. Ah, on va peut-être régler le souci, on va pouvoir vous le dire rapidement. On revient avec vous, James Moreau. Vous parliez donc de cette histoire américaine avec notamment les sorcières de Salem. On sait que en Europe aussi, évidemment, il y a eu des procès pour sorcellerie et des débats et des tas de choses. Même si l'épisode, évidemment, des sorcières de Salem est très particulier, est-ce que vous auriez pu décaler votre histoire ou faire la même histoire en Europe? Y avait-il des spécificités américaines?
That's an interesting question. I'd never thought about that before. Initially, I thought of The Last Witchfinder as part of a trilogy about taking on the grand theme of America, the American ethos, the American collective consciousness. So I never imagined it not including scenes set in America. But the point I ended up making in the novel, the axe that I was grinding, is celebrating the coming of the Enlightenment. And whatever you think of the Enlightenment and le siècle des Lumières, it has its critics. They're worth listening to be sure there is a dark side, as it were, to the Enlightenment. But à mon avis, in my view, it came along exactly when it was needed, and it put an end to the burning of witches on the continent and the hanging of witches in England. And so, indeed, the whole story of that rotation from the Renaissance worldview, in which demons are taken for granted, to what we now call early modern Europe and on into modernity, I could have told that story without leaving the continent of Europe, to be sure.
Alors, Lucius Shepard, est-ce que vous m'entendez correctement? Yes, super. on va vous poser la même question qu'à vos camarades auteurs. Comment est-ce que vous appréhendez cette conférence au titre Les États-Unis, un pays sans histoire? Est-ce que ça vous a choqué? Et est-ce que le matériau de l'histoire américaine vous intéresse dans vos romans?
The title of the panel is, I think, incredibly flattering because it suggests that the United States does not have a history of brutality, deceit, and stupidity as every other country in the world has. But, you know, I don't really believe that for a minute. You know, like, so, I mean, when Jim pointed out that he saw incidents of the age and every time he took a walk down the street, well, first thing I did when I got in my hotel room was turn on the television to a French MTV channel, you know, a video channel. And, like, the first song was called Un Peu de Blues by Christopher May. And, like, it was, like, about the blues. And then there was some bit about the Old West and horses. And then there was another bit about that referenced 1950s, 60s Harley choppers and that kind of culture. And he stayed in a motel called the Hustler Motel. So I would say that, you know, when you walk down the streets of France, you see an instance of American history in almost every, you know, store window. But, you know.
Je voulais vous parler notamment de Louisiana Breakdown. Vous intéressez peut-être pas à l'histoire historique, mais en tout cas à tout ce qui est mythe ou légende des États-Unis. Parlez-nous un petit peu de ce roman et comment est-ce que vous avez travaillé.
I just liked Louisiana because it's a weird place, and like you know, it's probably the weirdest place in America. But I'm not disinterested in American history. I'm disinterested in the broad view of American history because I can't possibly understand it. But in reference to Louisiana Breakdown, I was interested in just the whole idea of the culture of the little towns, the Cajun towns, and the little half Cajun towns in there, and all the religions. I mean, you have every street corner and every in New Orleans, you have, you know, a new religion. You have, you know, with a church with 4 members or 8 members or 10 members, and like Shango's a god, and I mean everything's a god. You know, they make their own gods and make them out of clay and put them up on the windowsill. So, I mean, it's like I'm just interested in that kind of, you know, that kind of phenomena. You know, where like in Kathmandu and in Nepal, when people can't find an image to worship, they sit down and make one, you know, and it doesn't have to be any particular god they're making. It's just the mana of that particular place.
Est-ce que ça veut dire que finalement on n'a pas besoin de 2 millénaires comme on a parfois l'impression de penser en Europe pour se créer ses propres légendes et mythologies?
Well, I don't really know what it means for Europe. I mean, you know, like I'm not a European, but like I wouldn't dare to speculate on that, you know. So, you know, it's like, I mean, for me, I wouldn't dare speak to Americans. I mean, basically, I'm speaking for myself. I mean, you know, like that was what interested me about the novel, and you know, I don't generalize from that.
Une petite question pour Glenn Cook. On l'a vu pendant le festival que vous vous intéressiez tout particulièrement à la guerre de 100 ans, donc entre la France et l'Angleterre. Est-ce que vous piochez des éléments dans, on sait que vous aimez l'histoire, dans l'histoire américaine, ou vous vous concentrez plus sur cette période de l'histoire européenne?
I don't use much American history because there's nothing I find terribly dramatic. I've always been a student, I suppose you'd call it, of the Civil War, because it is such an influence on all of the history of the country since then. It has shaped everything that has come. And anybody whose family has been in the country for that long, goes back that far, has still at this point some connection with that war. So you know, it shapes the thinking of people and whatnot. I've always been, as I say, interested in that era, and I've had members of my own family in the military throughout the last 2 centuries, some rather well-known ones in the early 1830s and 1840s. However, I have always been more fascinated by European and Middle Eastern history than the history of my own country, just because there's so much more depth, and I'm so much more fascinated by characters like the Black Prince and Robert Knollys and some of the oddball characters of the Hundred Years' War, or even of the characters of the Arab conquest and whatnot.
That answer your question? Oui, très bien. Petite question, Jasper, vous vouliez dire quelque chose de particulier? Comment est-ce que vous...
Oh, well, unlike Glenn, I often draw inspiration from American history. My most recent book to see print, the novella called Shambling Towards Hiroshima, set largely in the year 1945, during the months preceding the Japanese surrender in World War II. And it spins off of, for my money, an unhappy event in American history when the Smithsonian Institute in Washington planned to mount a very elaborate exhibit about Hiroshima, including the airplane, the Enola Gray, that dropped the bomb on the city, and photographs of what happened on the ground, the victims of this sneak attack. When some veterans organizations and the U.S. Senate got wind of this plan, they protested so vigorously that the directors of the exhibit, the curators, gave in, and the exhibit became nothing more than putting the airplane on view. So there's a motif throughout American history, I would argue, of denying much of our history. There's a right-wing revisionism happening right now vis-a-vis the thought of what we call the founding fathers, the authors of the Declaration of Independence, the authors of the Constitution. The claim is being made that they were very orthodox Christians. They were evangelical Christians, and that the United States was intended as essentially a Christian nation. I think it's very hard to make that case if you're interested in facts. The founding fathers were almost, to a man, what we now call free thinkers. They were deists, which is by no means synonymous with Christianity. Thomas Paine was essentially an atheist. Benjamin Franklin is on record as saying he did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. That doesn't sound like Christianity to me. The founding fathers were not atheists, as we now understand the term. And John Adams had beliefs that map on to relatively orthodox Christianity. But on the whole, it's a big lie. So anyway, getting back to the Second World War, my novel, Shambling Towards Hiroshima, imagines a parallel history in which the Navy, the United States Navy, has developed a biological weapon in tandem with the Army's creation of a physics bomb, the thermonuclear weapon, and the Navy's threatening to release these biological weapons on Japanese cities to end the war very quickly. These biological weapons take the form of giant fire-breathing lizards that strangely anticipate Godzilla. So I'm kind of retelling in form almost of a parable that moment in American history where we perhaps could have announced the success of the Manhattan Project. We could have told the world that it existed, which is what Truman's Assistant Secretary of Defense, James McCloy, thought was the only ethical or moral path. We didn't. It became a sneak attack. But in my novel, a Japanese delegation is allowed to view the horror of these Godzilla monsters and to consider, therefore, surrendering.
Well, there's a movie.
I would think so. Certainly, yes, there's some special effects in it.
I think we're looking at all this in a kind of parochial manner, in a way. The fact is, the complex fact, I just came back from Louisiana, by the way, 2 weeks in Louisiana, researching a novel set in Louisiana. Louisiana is a good example of what I'm talking about. American history and European history, American present in Europe, as the history we're making now, are just complexly intertwined. And also the myth of America is a European idea, not an American idea, a Euro-American idea. Louisiana, for example, the way America got Louisiana it was a kind of a minor aspect of a long war between France and England, where Napoleon, after having lost French Canada, or before Napoleon, really, realized that with the war that Britain and France were fighting, where the French were not doing so well at that point, that they really couldn't hold on to Louisiana. So they said, well, at least let's get some money for it. and sold it to Thomas Jefferson. And that, in turn, Louisiana, in turn, was a city that had been founded by French explorers. Then the Cajuns came down from the Mississippi to, from Canada, French, Spanish, New York was once New Amsterdam. The two histories are inextricably wound together, back to whether or not the Vikings were here, were in the States before Columbus, whether there are people before the Vikings. And America, I think, the myth of America and the reality of America for Europeans was a kind of precog vision of the world we have today, where it is completely interrelated. America had no consistent ethnic identity. It never has. And now the world doesn't either. And the myth of America is now as a place where people from all over the world come together and form a multicultural society with all its, advantages and flaws. That's the world we're in now. So America, up to a point, stood for the European dream, not the American dream, of a new kind of freedom that was a freedom of multiculturalism. Yeah, it was witch hunting. It was pirates in the Caribbean. It was the mythity of the Old West, the myth of the American Indians, also the Africanization of America is still a very strong theme in the whole thing. So it's this vast complexity, and I don't think we should be looking at this stage of the game at American history and the history we're making now as separate from Europe. It certainly isn't separate from the Middle East anymore, or from Afghanistan, or from India, or from China. It never was separate from Latin America, really. So I thought this when I looked at the title, that this panel was going to be more about what 9/11 has done to ongoing American history, ongoing world history, because that, I think, is a very, 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 very drastic inflection point in the history of the world, certainly in the history of America, certainly what happened to Tim Powers. Before 9/11, that couldn't have happened. I on the plane, I saw a movie called Children of Men, a British movie about people are completely sterile. There's a fascist dictatorship in England. And what is their secret police called? Homeland Security. This is before we had Homeland Security. Now we have it. That is a big, big, big change. And it's still going on. On the other hand, if you pull back the camera time-wise, you realize that that what's going on now, the last 10 years, is that this war is an aspect of a much, much longer conflict between Islam and Christianity, which to some extent was started by Christianity in the Crusades, again for complex reasons. And the situation we have now, in that sense, is something like what the Louisiana Purchase was like. That was a big thing in American history. It was a sidebar in a much longer war going on between Britain and France. It was Napoleon saying, well, I'm not going to be able to hold this territory anyway, so I'll just fob it off on Thomas Jefferson and get a couple of million dollars out of it instead of nothing. For us, it was profound in the history of the States because it expanded the 13 colonies all the way west, gave the American governments the idea of manifest destiny that, well, we got this far, let's go further. We can take the land from more Indians, as we ended up doing it in Louisiana Purchase in a certain kind of way, because the French had a different relationship with the Indian tribes than the British did. And that's why Canada is one of the reasons Canada is Canada and not part of the United States. Well, I'll stop doing this because it's too complex to go any further. But I think maybe we should start looking at this a bit.
I was going to say, I think of a remark that Kurt Vonnegut once made, that all of his fiction can be understood as taking on the theme of America as utopia. I think there was a sense in which, for many generations, that the emerging and ever-evolving country with its manifest destiny and many dark episodes was nevertheless exempt. This was the myth, sort of exempt from the a kind of European decadence, was exempt from the normal laws of history, a rather pernicious myth, but the waves of immigration spoke to that ideal. The founding fathers created a constitution that to this day is the law of the land. You can argue how functional it is, and there are many ways that people have done end runs around the constitution. And then, of course, there was always the myth of the frontier. If you didn't like the way your life was going, as the cities grew, you could always go west, you could always escape. But now, as you're saying, Norm, and I agree completely, we can't escape any longer. We can't escape history, and Americans are today, being an empire of sorts, our future and our actions and our military bullying are intimately connected to the destinies of so many people, perhaps all people in some sense, around the globe.
Well, you know what has become modern France? Well, the French Revolution and the American Revolution was so intertwined and so influenced each other at the same time, things ended up going different directions after a while. But, I mean, there again, you want to call that the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, although it wasn't always that reasonable, at least on the ground. I mean, Paine, Franklin, French Revolution, all of these things. I mean, there wouldn't have been an America without the French intervention. There might not have been a French Revolution without the American Revolution. It's all been intertwined from the very beginning, and we certainly cannot escape. The Fukuyama's thing was so ridiculous that capitalism is one, the Soviet Union is dead, it's the end of history. It's all going to be a capitalist utopia, corporate utopia, where world globalization is going to give everybody a lot of money. You've heard this story. Well, it's all over. We're at a point now. You want to talk about making history? We're at an inflection point in history now, I think. I wrote that this is Greenhouse Summer, Blue Coming Orange. Communism has been discredited. It's gone. That doesn't mean Marx was wrong about capitalism. The capitalist world globalization system right now is in the process of completely falling apart. It cannot exist like this anymore. It's full of singularities. The fiscal system is crumbling as we speak here. I don't know what the future franc, maybe. The euro is worth now. The banks have eaten their own shit and are choking to death on it. This is an inflection point in world history in which America and the European Union, among other things, are at the heart of it. And talk about long-term, short-term. The European Union is something new on this planet, something very complex that's been evolving from, from an American time viewpoint. It hasn't, it's been a long time. It's been like 20 years. From a longer perspective, it's been a very short time, and it's still evolving, and now it's reached an inflection point, a crisis, where it either has to fall apart or proceed to the next level of integration. While the globalized system, which Fukuyama thought was going to be the capitalist utopian system, is dead in the water. It's rotting. It's falling apart. So this is a period of chaos coming. And what comes out of it, we don't know. And maybe we should be writing more science fiction novels about these various alternate historical outcomes in the future.
Alors, je voudrais qu'on entende et Lucille Shepard et Glenn Cook. Lucille Shepard, justement, il y a beaucoup de choses qui se disent dans cette conférence et sur l'histoire américaine et sur l'état du monde aujourd'hui. Lucille Shepard, à la fois sur la Louisiane, Norman disait que c'était vraiment un creuset sur toute l'histoire américaine après, et à la fois aussi sur le mythe de la frontière. Qu'est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire si cela marche?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, not a lot because I don't think like that. I mean, my approach to writing is not from any kind of research. I hate research. I hate anything but the research I can do sitting in a bar or hanging around a cafe. Libraries put me to sleep. Like bookstores put me to sleep for that matter. And so it just doesn't, I mean, all through this convention, I've talked to people who know so much about history and are able to talk about it, but I'm not really able to talk about it. I look at people and I see what they're reacting to and how they're feeling, and that's what I write about. So I really don't think much about the frontier, I'm sorry.
Cook, vous vouliez réagir tout à l'heure?
Yeah, I think Norman made some very astute observations there. One thing he did say, and which I think is a myth that I would like to argue against, is that the conflict between Islam and Christianity began with the Crusades. This is not true. Everything that is now part of the Caliphate or was part of the Caliphate west of Baghdad was Christian before the Arab conquest. All of Central Asia mostly was Christian. What was not Christian was Jewish. Most of the tribes of those days were either Christian as part of their identity, Jewish as part of their identity, or Nabataean or some other form of animistic thing. The war between Christianity and Islam began the day that Muhammad came down from the mountain.
The only fact of Louisiana history that I know a little bit about, and as a satirist I respond to this, is the fact that the Battle of New Orleans was fought after a peace treaty had been signed between the two warring parties. So it was a kind of Kurt Vonnegut clownish battle that didn't need to occur.
Just going to say it was a problem of communications.
I don't disagree with what Glenn said about it. I didn't mean to. I don't want to get into the argument who started the war between Islam and Christianity. But
doesn't matter who started it.
The point being, whoever started it, it's still going on.
That's correct.
And both sides. Well, there's another thing here, which. Well, as a positive thing. Is that I think that if you look at human history over the past couple of thousand years or so, you do see a moral evolution. Things that were accepted, like that sort of thing, fight for territory, kill the infidel, kill the heathen, Slavery is perfectly acceptable, especially if you've got prisoners of war, like the Romans built their prison, their slavery empire. Perfectly, you know, nobody said anything, you know. That was up until 200 years ago. That was you know, the human ethos. Equality of women, how old is that? In some places, it isn't any. To a certain extent, there is a moral evolution. And the thing about Hiroshima is, and Frederick Brown, I think, wrote a very good thing about this in one of those short stories. We were very, very fortunate that the atomic bomb was dropped when it was. Because if it had been done in the middle of the war, when the Nazis had it too, we would have had World War, an atomic war, before people knew what the hell these things were really doing, and it would have been a catastrophe. If it had never been dropped, and you had the Cold War with the Americans and Russians competing for who could have the biggest megaton, until the Russians finally set off a 100 megaton thing, and the Americans said, okay, you got the prize. If things had been different, the Soviet Union disappeared. Its empire disappeared. It didn't use the bomb. The United States lost a war in Vietnam that it could have ended in about 20 minutes if it had decided to nuke North Vietnam out of existence. We didn't do it. They didn't do it. Nobody has done it since. And I think that's a kind of moral evolution in a longer term like that. And a connection with that, the idea of the myth of the frontier just occurred to me while Lucius was talking about this, and while Glenn was talking about this, that has a lot to do with science fiction and the American space program. Because basically, the idea, the visionary idea of expanding out into the solar system, the free asteroids, all that libertarian stuff, is an extension of the mythos of the frontier of the West out into space. Timothy Leary said to me, he says, like, you know, California is where all the crazy stuff went until it reached the edge of the ocean, and now it just has to go up and west out into the solar system. So there really, I think, is a connection between the myth of the frontier and the Americans and the American space program, anyway. As no accident that it was the United States was half of this and the Soviet Union was another half of it, which in some ways was a different ethos because of Tsiolkovsky and his view of the thing. So it's, in a long term, I guess what I'm trying to say, in the long term, I think, and the European Union being part of it too, where the idea of absolute sovereignty is dissolving. Because after all, what do absolute sovereign states really do to justify their existence? They fight wars and conflicts with other sovereign states. Nothing else they do is inherently involved with absolute sovereignty. So I think, over long term, we're ups and downs. We are seeing, in general, over the past couple of thousand years or so, a slow moral evolution as well as an economic and scientific evolution.
Il nous reste une dizaine de minutes. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question à leur poser sur l'histoire américaine? Allez-y, c'est l'occasion. Avec ce plateau, c'est la dernière journée. Non. Eh ben, ah oui, Claudine Bleu.
Non, c'est une question qui va peut-être être un tout petit peu à côté du débat, mais on a une connaissance assez partielle, bien sûr, de tout ce qui peut se passer dans la culture américaine. Moi, j'ai été frappée par quelques films qui sont un peu de l'ordre du nanar, d'ailleurs, et par quelques livres qui ne sont pas tout à fait le genre qu'on traite ici, qui sont plutôt du thriller ésotérique, où il y a comme une mystique vraiment recréer autour des pères fondateurs, autour des feuillets de la Constitution, autour de la Liberty Bell. Et je voulais savoir si c'était très ponctuel ou si c'est quelque chose qui se fait, qu'ils ressentent eux aussi en tant qu'historiens, du moins autour de ce débat historique.
Est-ce que quelqu'un veut répondre sur cette mystique des pères fondateurs ?
Well, I spoke to this a little earlier in the hour. There seems to be a war going on American soil right now, a war of ideas, to be sure, not a war of swords and blood, over the intention of the founding fathers. And the right wing of the Republican Party, that is to say, the Republican Party, is, I think, rewriting the history of the writing of the Constitution because they have there's a strong theocratic impulse in the right wing in American politics. It's very, very religious, and it gets people voting on their side. So it's if you can convince people that you're not only a very pious Christian politician, but somebody who understands that that's what America is all about, not religious freedom, but a kind of feel-good, smiley-faced theocracy, praise Jesus, you will prosper politically. That's my analysis of what's happening right now. And so that includes, yes, enshrining the Liberty Bell as if it was some kind of equivalent to the Holy Grail.
And I'm one of those guys that's over there on the right wing, and I am an atheist. And I would argue that much of what the Tea Party and whatnot are doing nowadays is trying to undo the myths that the left wing has created over the last 60 years. Yes, all of those things from the Founding Fathers' days are icons. They are holy things like statues of Mary and whatnot. And we rewrite their values constantly. Everybody rewrites history constantly. So the history that I was taught in the 50s and 60s is not the history that is taught today. Same facts happen, or the same events actually happen.
Pardon. It is sometimes said that the most important word in the United States Constitution is the word that isn't there, the word God. And those who would claim that there was a theocratic or specifically Christian intention behind the American experiment need to somehow reckon with that fact if they really wanted it to be a qualified theocracy or a tribute to faith. You'd think they would have said something like, we the believers, or we the Christians, or we the servants of God, rather than we the people, is the famous preamble to the Constitution.
You know, there was a radio personality, Gene Shepherd, who had a motto that said, you know, in God we trust, all others pay cash. And this whole Tea Party thing is an evil scam. It's an evil scam, cynically created by people like Karl Rove. The fact of the matter is that the Republican Party, the established Republican Party, was a party of the 99%, I mean of the 1% versus the 99%. It was a party owned basically by large corporate interests, by rich people. Well, you don't win elections by saying to the middle class, well, we're going to take the money from you, we're going to give it to a few rich people, vote for us, you'll like that. Well, you couldn't be elected dog catcher in Bucharest on a platform like that. So with Nixon and after Roosevelt, all they could come up with was Eisenhower because he was a war hero, so they were able to elect him. So they were on their ass. They hadn't had a they weren't winning congressional elections either. Then you had the 60s, where Nixon and later Reagan, they started running against hippies and drugs and rock and roll and blacks. Well, that ran a bit thin after Reagan. Well, Reagan was a transitional figure. The thing is, the Republican Party, to win an election, always has to run some kind of scam like that, because what it's really about, which is being the party of wealth and capital versus the American middle class and poor people, you can't win an election like that. You have to have something else. So they made a pact with the evangelicals, with people like Pat Robertson and so on and so forth, to run, we are the party. We are the party of religion. We are the party of God. Then they elected themselves George W. Bush, who tanked the economy. Well, people are starting to wake up. So the Tea Party is a party of genuine anger and genuine demand against the system that's screwing it, just as the new Occupy movement is the same thing from the so-called left. So the theocratization of the Tea Party is a scam by the Republican power structure to try and win an election that they can't win on economic grounds, because the country is on its ass, on religious grounds. It's a scam. It's a dead scam. It's two things. The really people who are really believers in the Tea Party, they have a point. They are the people who have been screwed. The people who created the party in the first place, talk radio, Karl Rove, stuff like that, these are cynical manipulators in the service of the dying system.
Glenn Cook.
However, you can get elected, as has been seen in our country and in most European countries, quite easily if you promise to punish those who are competent and those who are creative by taking away their incomes and giving it to people who don't create and don't. I'm angry right now. I like Norman, but this is something we will never, ever, ever agree upon.
Are you talking about people who ran Goldman Sachs or Lehman or the bad scam guys. Artists?
I agree with you 100%. Bad guys.
Those
bad
people,
guys, but
there
why?
Are two things. There are two things here. It's certainly legitimate to have a meritocracy where people make a lot of money by doing something that's worthwhile to the society, whether it's producing goods or real services or inventing things or making a good movie or having a best-selling book. But when it's a bunch of casino crap like these derivatives, which is tanking the euro,
100%.
These people are thieves.
I agree with
They're
you
thieves.
On that 100%. And I think probably one of the cures for many of the problems of the world is we don't shoot enough people. And those people probably should have been taken out in front of their damn building and shot right there. But I don't feel like I should have to be paying so goddamn much taxes.
Just Moreau.
Well, who are these undeserving people who receive the largesse of your unintended largesse of taxes? Who's getting this money?
We have people in my city who are now in their third generation where nobody in the family has ever held a job.
Could we talk about this for the next hour or two?
Why don't we just stay here? I mean, we would argue,
the stage.
But that's not really why we're here. We're supposed to be talking about American history. I just had to get a little something off my chest there.
Oh, allez, on a le temps pour une dernière question. Vous avez vu, le débat est animé. Hein. Mais il est aussi animé aux États-Unis que chez nous, donc c'est intéressant.
La question des natifs a été abordée tout à l'heure. Est-ce que la plupart des Américains d'origine européenne considèrent que l'histoire des États-Unis commence avec justement l'immigration, ou est-ce qu'ils incluent une partie de l'histoire des natifs?
Alors, qui veut répondre sur cette question?
Well, I think America is so pluralistic, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, as I began by saying, there's a kind of convenient amnesia among many of our citizens, sad to say. And yeah, for them, it begins with their own immigrant experience, and they sort of conveniently forget about the concentration camp conditions of the antebellum South, for example. Not to mention the unhappy history between the colonists and the Native Americans.
Norman.
Well, I agree with that, but that sort of thing is not, France is not immune from that too. They're still fighting about who was in the resistance during the war and whether it was collaborating with the Germans to continue being a cabaret performer. In our history, the present is the history of the future. As far as the future is going to be concerned.
C'est un joli mot de la fin. On arrive à la fin de notre table ronde. Merci à vous d'être venus. Vous allez les retrouver en dédicace. Et surtout, merci à nos invités.